First of all, I want to thank the committee, ever who it was, I don't exactly know. I think it was Bill and a bunch of other committee people that sent me my letter. It was a wanted poster. Said, you're wanted. So here I am. So I thank you. This has been a wonderful, wonderful roundup. One of the greatest I've ever been to. Workshop. God, I don't believe I've ever heard so much clapping alcoholics together. Clapping. I think he would have clapped if somebody would have dropped a pin. I sat back there a while ago and listened to the program chairman, and I couldn't hear him too good, and all at once everybody started getting up clapping. And, hell, I just got up too. This is my second workshop. I was up here a year ago, and I couldn't come back in October because I was down at the Area Assembly in Alabama, but I've really enjoyed this workshop, and it has been beautiful. I've seen a lot of people that I met last year, and I've seen a lot of new faces. I am Robert Horton, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, and you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink of alcohol since January the 24th, 1985. You know, I don't know. It really doesn't matter to me if that impresses anybody in here or not. But I know one thing. By God, it impresses me. It impresses me. I drank 38 years. And I know that I drank alcoholically for at least 30 years. And during that 30 years that I was drinking alcoholically, I tried every way conceivable to drink alcohol and get that feeling that I once felt. And it never came. It just never did come. And finally, I found this program. And this has been the most wonderful program that I've ever been in my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If anybody hadn't come up to you today and told you that they love you, I want to tell you that. I love you. I see so many people coming in, young people coming in Alcoholics Anonymous today. It just thrills me. It makes me feel good all over because I know that's the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, is young people. I remember when I come in and I came in and got sober 11 years ago, we didn't have near as many young people. It very seldom we'd have a young person come in my group. Now we have them all the time. 19, 20, 22, 23 years old. I see people that's 23 years old, been sober 8 years. Everywhere I go, and I go a lot. I cannot remember, I couldn't tell you right now when the last time I could remember that I didn't go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've been to one every day for so many days, I don't even know how long it's been. I go to my own home group about 4-5 times a week. I double dip some days. I'll go to the no-smoker meeting at 5:30 and I'm a smoker. But then I'll pick somebody up at the Serenity Home or the Fellowship House, and I'd hell of a lot rather pick the ones up at the Serenity Home and the Fellowship House. The gals are at the Serenity House. And I don't like to just pick up two of them. I tell them that. I like to pick up six, because if I can pick up six of them, we all crowd in that car, and I'm right close to one of them, see. Lord, have mercy. And, you know, I know there ain't no women here tonight, but you know, I love the gals in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love them so damn much. I tell them all the time, I just love you to death. And I say, I like to look you over. And they look at me, and they don't say anything. They sort of look at each other. But you know, I tell them then, I say, you know, I'd a lot rather look you over than overlook you. And I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, we do have about 37-38% women in AA now. And I'm married, and I've been married so damn long. I've been married 44 years pretty soon to the same woman. July the 11th will be 44 years. Now, she divorced me way back there in the 60s. You know, she's trying to get even with me. She committed me. I've wound up in a mental institution for the insane a couple of times. I don't know how many times I've been to the VA and all this and that, and I don't care anything about getting on a drunk log. But I do know this. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's this book right here. I love this book, and I live by this book, and I know this book tells me what I must do. It tells me I'm to share with you how I was, what happened, and what I'm like today. And that's all I can do. I don't know nothing else to share with you about. I'll talk to you just like Bill Wilson sat down and talked to Bob. And you know, Dr. Bob wasn't going to give Bill 15 minutes. 15 little minutes is all he's going to give that man, and he gave him 5 hours. They talked for 5 hours. I don't know how long I'm going to talk. I have a pretty good idea. Don't pay no attention to when I'm looking at my watch. That's a habit. You know? It's just a habit. Because I don't have no idea when I stop. I know one time I was talking, and it was on a Thursday night. And I'd been talking a pretty good little while, and I thought I'd gotten wound up, and I looked up, and it wasn't this many people. It's about 200 people. And people started filing out the back door. And, man, I bowed down. I thought, my God, you know, these people, I'm not holding their attention. And I started bowing down a little bit. Some more started getting up and going out. And God, all these seats in here got where they was empty, and it got down to about 4 or 5 aisles. And I said, oh, hell fire. I really started bowing down then, you know. And they started filing out. It got down to where there was one fella left right there on the front aisle. When they all got out, I just stopped. And I walked over to him. And I said, buddy, how come you're still here? He said, hell, man, I'm tomorrow night's speaker. But I got a sponsor, and he lives up here in Atlanta, Georgia, out of Jonesboro, Frankie R. And Frankie don't ever talk too long. He used to say, if you can't say what you want to say in 30, 40 minutes, just sit down. I never could take after Frankie. I tried, and I tried, and I tried. But I never just could follow in his footsteps. So it takes me a little longer than that. But don't really get worried. Don't get worried. We'll all get out of here, and I'm enjoying it anyway. I don't know whether you are or not. I know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs, and that's what I'm doing here. You see, I stay sober. This is one of the ways I stay sober at Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had a desire to take a drink either in those 11 years. Hadn't thought about taking a drink. Never has crossed my mind. And people get in arguments with me sometimes, and they say, I really don't believe you. I say, well, look here. It doesn't matter to me. Whether you believe me or not, I know how I feel. I was about 17. I was 17 years old when I took my first drink of alcohol as a senior in high school. I'm a country boy. I was raised in the country. I lived so far back in the sticks, they had the pipe sunshine in there. And my dad drank. And I mean, he drank. Everybody drank back then. There was just a few people that didn't drink back then. They drank white liquor. My God, they'd get together on a Saturday night and they'd have what they call a barn dance. Box suppers and things like that. And I was a little kid, and men would go around in the back of the building. And for a long time, I didn't know what them fellas was doing. And then I figured out what they were doing because they'd come back in, they couldn't hardly walk. You know, I was the type of drunk that, I was a drunk, and an e-walking baby drunk. The three types of drunks, and I was all three types. I was a drunk, and I was a knee-walking baby drunk. I couldn't walk. But I was 17 years old when I took my first drink of alcohol. Even back then, my dad drank, and I didn't ever see him sober hardly on the weekends. My dad died when he was 47 years old of an alcoholic seizure. And I felt ill at ease. And I felt out of place. I felt inadequate. And at my junior and senior high school dance banquet, I was with this friend of mine that had been off in service World War II. And he was about 3 years older than me, and he'd come back, and he was going to high school. And I went with him, and he told me, said, now, Robert, said, I've got a pint of whiskey and a quart of wine under the front seat of the car. Said, you might want to take a little drink if you want to. So we walked in that auditorium, and I sat down and sort of had my head down. I looked around. Looked like that bunch of people in there was just, they didn't look like y'all. You know, this is a beautiful crowd. I love to see people laugh, smiling, alcoholics and nuns. That's what it's all about. But these people weren't smiling. They weren't having a good time. They're just a bunch of sulked up people. And I thought, my God, what's wrong with y'all? Well, I went out to the car a little bit. I reached up on that seat and I said, I'm going to take me a little shot of this. And I got me a shot of that wine. I guzzled that thing down a little bit. I guzzled a little more down. I walked back in that auditorium and I sat down and I looked around. Everybody in there was smiling. Everybody in there was having a good time. The men was a-dancing and the girls was a-dancing. They was all having a good time. And I thought, my God, you sure have changed all at once. I went back to the men's room and I looked at myself in the mirror. And I took my comb out and I started combing that pretty black hair of mine. And I said, boy, get in there and get in there now. Them gals is in there just waiting for you. I took off back in there and I had me one up and I was a-dancing and I was having a ball. A little bit, I go back out to that car. I drank a little more of that wine. I go back in. I comb that pretty black hair again. I start dancing again. A little bit, I go back out to the car. I knock the top out of that pint, and I drank every bit of it. Sick the next morning. I was sick. I wouldn't go home. Didn't want my mama to see me. So I went home with old Buster. And he had his own apartment at home, fixed where he could go out the side door. So me and him went in that side door, and I laid there, and I was sick the next day. I thought, I don't want no more of this. Right after that, I went in the Navy. This was 1947. And I got on the football team in the Navy, and I was on the football team in high school, and I thought, see, if I got on the football team, this is going to change the way I feel. I won't feel ill at ease, and I won't feel out of place. So I got on the football team out there in San Diego, NCC, and I stayed there 3 years, and I got to drinking, and I got to having fun. I was having fun. Every once in a while, I'd get drunk. And I knew why I got drunk. I didn't mean to get drunk. I really didn't mean to get drunk, but, you know, if you drank as much as I was drinking, you're going to get drunk. And I was drinking a pretty good bit. So after about 3 years of this going out and drinking three or four nights a week, I had a blackout one night at the University of Northwestern after a football game they played. We had flew to the Great Lakes and played them in football 1949. And this was on Thanksgiving Day. And Saturday, they carried us out to the University of Northwestern to watch a football game. And I don't remember anything after that football game. I don't remember anything till Tuesday when we got back to San Diego. They told me I had a good time. You know, I got to wondering about that. And I will tell you right now, that's one of the things that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will tell you this right quick, that pain did not get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. If pain had got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1965 when I was committed to the Mental Institution of Insane, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And then committed again in 1967. And I was there 42 days in that old building. And if pain had got me here, I would have came to Alcoholics Anonymous then, because I did come to meetings. I did go to meetings. They made me go, and I was tickled to death to go. But I don't remember anything. But my drinking, it got worse and worse. It started progressing, and by the time I got discharged, the Korean War was started, and I come home, and I couldn't find a job. My dad finally found a job. I got on the police force in the city of Gadsden. And I was walking the beat at night from 11 to 7 in the morning, and I'd meet some of my buddies at 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd drink together. And then at 5:30, I would go get in a used car and go to sleep and get up at 15 minutes to 7 and bust her out. And one morning, I didn't make it. It was 9:15 to 9 when they found me. But being a good con man, I could lie, and I could cheat, and I could steal, and I could do all of these things that a good alcoholic does. You know, I didn't go fishing on Sunday, and I didn't play golf on Sunday. I drank on Sunday. And I did all these things, and I talked myself out of it. And it wasn't long after that that it happened again, and I got fired. So I stayed on that police force 6 months there in the city of Gadsden. And then I got a real job. I got the best job that I ever had in my life that I wished that I could have helped on to. And that was a better job than the one I retired at. And I retired with 30 years with Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company there in Gadsden, Alabama. But this was a job with George W. Helm Tobacco Company. I was a snuff salesman. That's just what I was. And I loved it. I simply loved it. I worked about 9 counties, and then about every 4 or 5 months, I'd work 37 counties in Alabama. And, man, I'm a-going every night, and I'm drinking, and I'm going out here, and I'm working the wholesale grocery stores, and I'm working the grocery stores. And back then, there wasn't a lot of supermarkets like we have today. They were mostly small, individually owned, big, large grocery stores, and I worked out in the country, and I'm out there giving out samples. I knew everybody that used, drank alcohol. I knew the ones that was making white liquor. I knew the ones that kept white liquor in the store, and I'd carry a gallon of white liquor behind my back seat. front seat and give it to them. And I'm drinking all the time, and I'm having a ball. Well, after I wore out my first car, I decided I didn't want a black car or a dark blue car like the rest of the snuff salesmen did. So I talked to my division manager, and he says, I don't care for the salesman buying their own car. Said they can go up, you can go anywhere you want to get the best deal. Said we always get a fleet price. So they told me to go up to Albertville, Alabama and buy my car, and I went up to Smith Motor Company, and I told this manager up, I said, now I tell you what I want. I want a canary yellow. I wonder why. I don't know. I might have been self-conceited. I might have been selfish. I don't know. I might have had a lot of self-centeredness. I think what it was an egotistical self-centered maniac with an inferiority complex. That's what I think I was. So I ordered me a canary car, canary yellow car. I had that thing 6 months, and it had four colors to it. Had four colors. Front end didn't look like the back end didn't look like the front end, left door didn't look like the right front door, and the right back door didn't look like the left back door, and the left back door didn't look like the right back door. The left front door didn't have no paint on it whatsoever. Now, you know, if you're going down the highway about 60 miles an hour, squirting snuff juice out the window, it hits the side of your car, and when you wash it, it just all comes off. Well, the rest of the car didn't match because I'd done tore this right fender off. Part of that right fender was on your car somewhere. And I'd had to have it painted, and old Olin Bryant there, he was a body man back at that time, Olin would say, Robert, I can't match the paint. I can't match this canary yellow on this car. So about 3 weeks later, I'd be having the left rear door worked on. Maybe about 3 months later, I'm having the right rear door worked on. Because if you had your car on the side of the street, and I'm going down that street at 2 o'clock in the morning, I might just take your fender clean off and go down the street about a block and stop and look back and cuss you out for leaving your car on the street. I never could figure out why the people didn't park the car, half of it up on the grass and half of it on the sidewalk. I never could figure that out. You know, I didn't think they were supposed to park in front of their house, but that's the way they were really supposed to park, out in front of their house. But I'd get mad. And I remember getting mad back when I was 4 years old. Now, I don't know whether any of you fellas in here can remember when you was 4 years old or not, but I can very well. I had a first cousin that me and him was always playing with June bugs. Y'all know what June bugs are? Anybody here old enough know what a June bug is? Well, we used to get a string and tie a June bug to a string and let it fly. Well, this dad-blamed first cousin of mine, he got a bumblebee. And he was about 3.5 years older than me, and he brought it over to my house on my fourth birthday. June 8, 1933. I'll never forget, as long as I live. June 8, 1933. He come over to my house with this bumblebee tied to this string and said, Sonny boy, I got you a June bug. Well, I looked at that thing and I thought he was trying to pull something on me. I thought he had a tummel turd. Now, I don't know whether any of you people live out in the country or not that had outdoor toilets know what a tummel turd is or not. But I lived in the country and we had an outdoor toilet. And it didn't make no difference to me if it was a tummel turd or a June bug. That was okay. I'd let them fly on the string. But I took this thing and I was letting it fly around, and it flew till it gave a plumb out and it hit the ground. And I reached down to pick the tummel turd or the June bug up, and it stung me. 4 years old. I was in the fifth grade when I paid him back. I was 10 years old when I paid him back. And by this time, I had a resentment at a lot of my other cousins and some more of my little neighbors, too, that I played with, because we were always playing knock the can. Back in those days, you'd take an old tin can, go around behind the house where the barn was, and you hit that thing, and you'd go hide. And the little goat had to go look for it and then find you. And I was always the goat. So the boys one day, they all went and hid. And it was in July, and it was hot, and they all got up in the attic of my aunt's house, my aunt and uncle's house. And I knew where they was. Boy, I had them, son. I had them. I went in that cupboard door, and I saw that little ladder going up there, and I eased that little door too, and I snapped that damn Yale lock. And I come back down, and I snapped that other lock, and I went home. And I left them. I left them locked up. I got it. Now, you're talking about resemblance. I grew up with resemblance. I grew up with it. So, you know, my drinking and everything, you know, I had the disease of alcoholism. Physical, mental, spiritual, body, mind, and soul. All the way, 100%. My God, my drinking got so bad that I'm drinking every day and every night. I lost that job at Helm Tobacco Company because of having wrecks and tired cars up. And was having a big banquet one night at the Bankhead Hotel in Birmingham. And D. Woody was a vice president of George W. Helm Company, and he was on the board of directors of Helm Tobacco Company. And they came down there to a sales meeting, and I'm having to go to the sales meeting, you know, and I stopped at Fred and Jean's. And, you know, I was one of these fellas that always liked one drink. I don't know about y'all. I thought I had to have one little drink. One little drink made me feel better. So I stopped at old Fred and Jean's down there. I had one little drink. Went on down to Dutch Tavern in Trussville, Alabama. Had two or three more little drinks. Met my buddy on the parking lot of the Bankhead Hotel. We had a pint and a half, 2 pints, something like that. I went to the sales meeting. I went to the sales meeting and just fell out. I didn't have no blackout. I passed out. I just fell out. Well, you know, I've been traveling 7 years, staying in a suitcase and living in a little motel. There was no big hotels and motels back in those days. They were just little shiny shacks. I mean, there was no big motels like we have today. And I went across the street from the Bankhead Hotel, called my wife, and I said, honey, I said, you know what? I said, I need to be at home with you and the 2 kids. I said, I'm getting tired of living out of this suitcase. She said, yes, but what you going to do? Now, my wife had a good job. Now, I already had a resentment against her. Had a bad one. I resented her because she worked for South Central Bell Telephone Company, and she made more money even back then than I did. And I didn't like that. I wanted to be the man of the house. And I wanted to be the boss. I never could boss nothing. I never did have sense enough to boss nothing. But anyway, she said, what you going to do? I said, well, I done quit. And she had to come to Birmingham pick me up. And I didn't tell her I got fired, but I did. And then I got a job with Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, and my alcoholism got worse and worse and worse and worse. This is only in the 50s. And in the 60s, I started getting in jail. I started going in VPs. And I was in the county jail, been there 11 days, and they got me out and told me I was going to Bryce, and I was committed. When I come out of there and come home, less than a year and a half, I was committed again. I stayed in the county jail this time 9 days, and they carried me down. And there was no program for alcoholism or drug addiction back then. I was really down there with the nuts, the people that were insane. And I come out always with the thought of, I know what's wrong. I just drank too much. All I have to do is just not drink quite as much. And maybe I could stay off of it back then, maybe a month or 2 months. And then one day, you know, I'd be tired. So tired that I couldn't hardly walk. Because poor me was working twice as hard as everybody else in that Goodyear. See, I was doing the job of 2 people. And I deserved a little drink. And the gasoline was dry. And I'd go to my black bootleggers and I'd say, Bessie, you know, I've stopped drinking. I don't drink anymore, but I'm tired today, Bessie. And please promise me something. Don't sell me but just a couple of little shots. See? And I'd take a little drink, and Miss Bessie would pour me another little drink. Best liquor you ever drank in your life. Every week. Boy, now, wasn't that good stuff? Oh, damn it. I don't reckon I ever thought about drinking real good liquor. I just really didn't care. I drank for one reason only, and that was the effect I got out of it. That's why I drank white liquor so long. I got a big kick out of white liquor. But anyway, that was good liquor if I could get Evan Williams. And I'd take a couple of drinks and she'd say, now, okay, Mr. Robert, time you go on home to Miss Jerry. I said, well, Miss Bessie, look, you know, you don't even see me stagger. I don't even feel this. Well, if you don't get it here, you can get it somewhere. She poured me another drink. and drunk. I go home. I stay a while. I come back to town. I go home drunk, drunk. I stay a while. I come back to Miss Bessie. I go home, and I'm knee walking, baby drunk. And that went on for 30 years, almost 30 years. I do not know how many times I was in the VA hospital or being dried out in the Baptist hospital. I'd get my doctor, and he'd put me in there, and I'd tell him I was having a nervous breakdown or I had been working so hard that he had to help me. And you know, I don't know how I could do this, but I could make it for 2 days before I'd call my doctor and tell him that I needed help. I didn't want him when he run a blood test to find all that alcohol contents in my body. Sometimes I'd make it 3 days, and I'd call Dr. Duncan. I'd say, Dr. Duncan, I've been here 3 days, and I'm hurting so bad, I'm dying. I need help. I'm just working too hard. I could lay there on that bed and hurt for 3 days and want to tie myself down because I did not want him to know that I had that much alcohol contents in my body. And he'd get me in the hospital and drive me out. And he knew what was wrong. And my wife left me in 1983. And she was gone 3 days. And I don't know how many times she left me, but she left me many a time. Just hop in the car and take off. She couldn't be around me. My son, my oldest son, had died by this time of cerebral palsy, and I was blaming God for everything. And I had another son. He graduated from high school in 1974, and I wouldn't have a thing to do with him. He wasn't even looking at dead. He wouldn't even have anything to do with me at all. And my wife and him left, and they came back home after 3 days. And she came in the house, and the house was all messed up, and it had whiskey bottles that I had laid there 3 days prior to this, but I hadn't drank, laying there in the last 3 days because I couldn't. I couldn't even answer the telephone. I was so paranoid. If the phone rang, a lot of times my wife come home and found me hid under the bed. I would be hid under the bed. But she came home. And she walked into the bedroom and she said, I don't know why we came back, but me and Bobby talked about it. And we decided to come home and offer you help if you wanted help. And I wanted help more than anything else. And never before in my life had I even looked at myself. I always looked at everybody else, what everybody else had done wrong. Never looked at what Robert Horton had done. But I looked at what Robert Horton had done this time, and I wanted help, and I said, yes, honey, I'll do anything you say. And they hauled me off to a treatment center. I didn't even know what one was. I didn't know what an alcohol and drug treatment center was. I didn't know what How Are You 5-0 was. Never had seen it. Never did see it till I got sobered up and come out. I didn't know what a video was. I didn't know what anything was. But I went to this treatment center, and I'd been laying there 3.5 days, and I hadn't drank. And they checked me and put me in detox one day. And they sent me up to what we call Lodge 4. I was at Warrior, Alabama, north of Birmingham, going towards Covenant at Brookwood. And I was there a week and a half, and I don't remember what went on. And when I come to myself and knew what was going on, I was in the cottage, and a little short fella that had a little black mustache come up the steps, and he had a 12 by 12 in his hand, and he came over to me, and he throwed it at me and says, this is a 12 by 12. This is AA literature, and says, I want you to read right here out of it. And I said, you read it if you want to. He read it. And he never took his eye off of me. And when he got through, he walked over to me and said, sit down. And he says, I'm an alcoholic. He says, I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 17 years. I thought, you're a damn liar. I don't believe that. He says, you've got a big book, and this is my big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read this book every day. I study this book every day. By the grace of God, I got sober. I said that a while ago. This book keeps me sober. Keeps me happy, joyous, and free. And he told me, said, I want you to read that big book, and I want you to read the 12 by 12 and Living Sober. And I started reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wouldn't even go to bed at night. And they started saying, that old man's crazy. He won't even, and they'd come down there and won't give me these pills to take, make me right. I wouldn't take them. I just refused to take them. And I'd read that big book all night long. I got home, and I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me to go to meetings, and I went to so many meetings, I couldn't even keep up with the meetings that I went to. I was going all over the 4th District and going to Birmingham and elsewhere, because we only had 3 meetings at Coosa Valley at that time. And Coosa Valley is my home group, and that's in Gadsden, Alabama, and I love that group. It's a great group. It's the best group I've ever been in. If I didn't think it was, I'd find another. But I started going to Coosa Valley, and we had 3 meetings a week at that time. And I'd go all over the district. I'd go up to Albertville, Gunnersville, Huntsville, Anniston, Oxford, Talladega, Sylacauga, Childersburg. I'd go to Birmingham. I'd go all over Birmingham, Bessemer, Hueytown, and all of them places. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous everywhere, and I got to know everybody. And man, let me tell you something. I was working this program. I wasn't doing nothing but going to meet. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had became unmanageable. I think that's all I've done. I was going everywhere and telling everybody how to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hadn't even thought about step 2. Was asked to start talking in Alcoholics Anonymous after 8 months. I said, yeah, sounds like a good idea. I've got a lot by God to tell these drunks. Most of them don't know how to drink. In 4 more months, I'm drunk as a dog. I'm drunk as a dog, running wild in an old 1964 car that I still had that I bought new. It's an antique, and that was my drunk car. And I'm a running that thing all over the country, just drunk as everything. And I sat down and thought, I better do something. But I knew I couldn't stop. I couldn't make a decision or anything back then. I was like the story in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the man trying to make a decision. If I just tried to make a decision that afternoon, I'd get thinking about it. I'd go to my bootlegger and have a few shots, and the next day I'm drunk and I couldn't even go to work. Couldn't do anything. Alcohol was no longer a luxury. It was a necessity. And I read that in Bill's story in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just the way it was with me. And I put myself in Cullman, Alabama, in a detox up there, and he kept me 5 days. That was on a Thursday, and Monday night I went to the AA meeting. Father Hillary gave me my white chip. So I came back to Coosa Valley and I started going to meetings. And this little fella that told me to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, start studying it, told me it wasn't gone with the wind. He said, you know, you read novels. By God, I want you to study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So he was up there at this detox place working. And me and him became real good buddies. He started coming down to see me. He'd spend the night with us every weekend, or I would be at his house every weekend. Most of the time, he'd be at my home on Friday and Saturday night. Next week, me and my wife would be at him and his wife's home on the next week. And we studied the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous together and the 12 to 12 for 2 years like that. And I'm going to meetings. And he said, Robert says, have you ever done the second step? I don't think so. What he told me. This was after about the 3rd day in detox. I'd come to myself and I knew what I was doing. And I said, no. I says, I just can't do that, Bob. He said, oh yeah. He said, are you willing? And I said, pretty willing. He said, are you open-minded? I said, yeah. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous don't care what you believe. He said, you can believe anything you want to believe. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religion, it's spiritual, and the whole program is spiritual. He said, every part of Alcoholics Anonymous is spiritual. He said, it was spiritual when you walked in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody walked up to you and hugged your neck and said, I love you. He said, that was spiritual. He says, if you're willing to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity, you have just worked step 2. He says, now get on step 3. And I said, I just can't do that. He says, oh yeah, you can. He says, let's read it together. He says, let's do it together. He picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and set me on the side of the bed and he read the 3rd step prayer to me. He says, you want to do the 3rd step prayer with me or you want to do it by yourself? And I said, I'll go in the bathroom. And I went in the bathroom And I said, God, deliver me from the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will, that I may better come with maximum service to you and to others. God, if it be thy will, take the desire to drink alcohol away from me. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. I was hurt. You know, folks, I'm serious. I'm really serious. I was crying. I was really hurt. And I come back in, Bob says, what's the matter? I said, Bob, nothing happened. He sat down beside the bed with me, and he picked up this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous again. He says, let's read this again. And he made me read it with him. He had a book, and I had a book. And he would stop me when I'd get so far. And he said, if you're honest about this step, sometimes a great effect is felt at once. And that's just what I read. It said, sometimes a great effect is felt at once. And he said, you know, that don't mean all the time. He said, maybe 10 people out of 100 have the type of spiritual experience that Bill Wilson did. The rest of us, it comes to us gradually and slow. And he says, let's read on the next page. And he read me and him 2 more lines at the bottom of that page, and we read together on the next page. He says, though this decision is a vital and crucial step, it is to little permanent effect, unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which are blocking us. Our liquor is but a symptom of the problem. We have to get down to causes and conditions. You are now at step 4. By God, he says, you're going to get rid of the things that's blocking you from growing spiritually in the spirit of the universe. And he says, that's the way this program starts. Action! He says, it's action. He said, you've got to do something for yourself. And he started telling me about all these resentments that I had about my wife sending me to Bryce in 1965, and I couldn't even eat breakfast with her without hurting. I couldn't even speak and talk to my son. He couldn't talk with me. I couldn't talk with nobody I worked with. I'd get so mad and angry. And he picked that book up, and me and him read it together, so we write this down. We write this down. Institutions, people are named. People that we're angry with. Not necessarily a deep-seated resentment, but people that we're angry with are institutions. And he explained to me about our social instinct and our security instinct and my sex instinct. And he said, you're out of whack on all of it. Boy, he was telling it to me. And I had to get down to causes and conditions. And I did that. And I had to write down the names of the people I had fear of. My God, can you imagine? You're supposed to be getting off work at 11 o'clock at night, and you're calling your wife every night and telling her, you know, you're getting off from work, and you tell her you're working over. And hell, you're getting in your car, and you're going to East Gadsden, and you're going upstairs at a back alley and hopping between the sheets. And I had all this guilt and remorse, and it turned into fear. And I had fear of these people that knew what I was doing, because I knew that they was going to call her and tell her. I had a resentment against a lot of people, the sheriff, the deputy sheriff, the probate judge, and especially the jailer up there, because when I was there in the county jail in the DTs, he was calling my wife trying to make out whether or not I wanted to shoot and kill him when I got out of Bryce in 1965. I had a list. Wish you could saw it. I had a long list of everybody that I hated. And he got that book, and we read on over there on about the 4th page, and he said, you're going to start looking at yourself. A true evaluation of oneself. We was talking about humility there, Jimmy, was this afternoon. Great, great meeting. At 4 or 5. To me, a true evaluation of oneself is the way I look at it. And I had to quit looking at other people and start looking at my own. And ask myself a few questions. Where had I been at fault? Where had I been wrong? Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and inconsistent? I had to do all those things. And my God, did I have a sex inventory. Did I have a sex inventory. When I got married, my wife was going to school, South Central Bell, had her going to school, and I took my mama, my mother, to Daytona Beach, Florida, and I met 3 gals down there that I'd been dating back in Gadsden, Alabama, and I was just knocking notches in my belt going and coming. And just had got married. That's enough about that.
Pepsi, Pepsi.
I didn't want to do it. I found that little loophole on page 74. You can't find somebody you want to do it with right now. You postpone this step. I postponed that thing because I started hurting again. And when that guilt and that remorse and that fear started coming back, by God, I got down to business. And I got me somebody that I trusted in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I done it. And in 1986, I got me a sponsor here in Atlanta, Georgia, Frankie R. Frank's got a sponsor. And his sponsor lived in Gadsden, Alabama, and his sponsor was Dr. Bob. So today I have a sponsor, and I called him. I went by to see him yesterday. He lives in Jonesboro, nursing home. And I got him to be my sponsor in 1986. And he got serious with me. And he told me, he says, you've got to go right on. And I did. And I thought, you know, if I'm entirely ready to have God take away these defects of character, all I have to do is say the 6-7 prayer, step prayer. Boo, boo, boo. That's all the big books got in there. So I finally made me a list. And then I felt real good. Do you know, the guilt and the remorse and the fear and the resentment stayed with me. Didn't nothing leave after I wrote it down. When it left was when I went to another person. Like, for instance, I had my best friend that worked with me at Goodyear, lived 3 doors from me. I went to him drunk, borrowed his Frenchie, 20-gauge automatic shotgun, and went and pawned it. And when my wife came down to the VA to get me out, I had 5 DWIs and 9 damn pawn tickets in my pocket that I had borrowed stuff from my best friend and went and pawned. And it was hard to go look at him in the face and say, I'm in a program. And I think you know what it is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. In order for me to be free, I have to do something. I have to tell you that I want to make amends to you. I'd do that with all these people. My wife, my son was first, and all that. You know, all I do today is continue to take personal inventory when I'm wrong. I don't think there's a person in here like to eat crow. I don't think none of us like to eat crow. If there's anything that I hate to do is look at my wife and say, honey, I'm sorry, I was wrong. God, I don't like to do it. But I don't like that guilt, and I don't like that remorse, and I don't want no fear coming back in my life. And my wife's in Al-Anon today, and you know, Alcoholics Anonymous says we cooperate with Al-Anon, but we're not affiliated. Bullshit, I'm affiliated with Al-Anon. My wife's Al-Anon, and I am affiliated with her, and she's been in service work for 8 years, and goes to everything, and she is tickled to death right now that I'm up here. I'll guarantee you that. Because she's on the phone right now talking to some Al-Anon. She likes me just get plumb out. And you know, we have such a wonderful relationship today. You know, we do. I love her. I love my wife. And she loves me today. And she lets me do what I want to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I pray. And that's all I can do is ask God for knowledge of what His will for me is and the power to carry that out. I do that. And service work. My God. This little fella here in Atlanta, Georgia, told me in 1986, April of 1986, get in service work, boy. You need to get in service work. He had served as a delegate for the state of Georgia in 84 and 85. And he told me, he says, you get in service work. And, you know, I don't know how I got in it, but that year, in October of 86, I was asked to be alternate GSR of my group. Now, boy, I thought, I'm cotton high, boys. I'm gonna be the big GSR at Coosa Valley. And I got elected GSR. They elected some woman, didn't stay GSR, but about a month. You know, and she called me one day. She said, I don't like this. I'm gonna tell them to get them somebody else. And I said, that suits me. This suits me just fine. So I fell right in as GSR and went on, you know, and I was DCM, often DCM, and then DCM. And today I'm serving in as a trusted servant with area. A1, Alabama, Northwest Florida. And I love service work. And it's my life. It's my life. I work with a lot of people today. But I want to tell you a little story, something that happened about, this happened 3 years ago. My son works at Dixie Pacific, and he got a finger cut off. And his wife and her mother rushed him to Birmingham, and they sewed it back on. put his finger back on. And he would call over at my house and tell my wife, he'd say, Mom, reckon you can get Dad to run me to Birmingham down there. You know, he'd drive me while I see my doctor. Hey, this went on for a full month. Now, he was going about every 2 or 3 weeks to see his doctor. One day he called Mom. He said, Mom, I said, I got something to tell you. This is fabulous, brother. Said, you know all them trips Dad's been running me to Birmingham? Said, I can drive down there. Yep, that's what he said, George. He said, I can drive back down there. Said, Mom, I'd like to be with Daddy. Said, I love him. And he said, Daddy talked to me now. And Daddy never talked to him, never had nothing to do with him. I wasn't nothing but a drunk, knee-walking baby drunk. And this program of Alcoholics Anonymous set me free. The truth shall set you free. And I didn't have any of that freedom until I made me a list and went to these people and sat down and talked with them, and I've never had but one yet to say, I don't care about talking with you. And that didn't even bother me. And today there's 14 street people live on my in my neighborhood. I built the first house on that street, Cornelia Circle, way on the backside of the river, and the backwaters behind my house. All 13 of my neighbors come over at my house all the time talking to me about how can I put this rubber out, how can I put this out, how do I need to put these trees out and these fruit trees out, and what do I put my tomatoes out, and what kind of the best tomatoes to put out, and all that. And I don't ever see them going to none of the rest of the neighbors' houses. And I'm an alcoholic. And they know it. They know it because I let them know. And if any of their kids or nephews or nieces has got a problem with alcohol, they sometimes say, how about you talking with them? And I go to church today. You know, I remember reading and studying the chapter to the Agnostic. I read that thing so many times. And way back in there it says, we beg of you, talking about the first 105 people who helped Bill Wilson write the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, says, we beg of you to lay aside all prejudice against organized religion. Paraphrase. I go to church today. I'm happy in church today. Guess what I don't do today in church? I don't try to run it. 1975, the last time that I was at the VA, they kept me 5 days and throwed me out. And I do not know how many times I was there. I know I was there 31 days, 14 days, 11 days, and 8 days. I don't know how many times I was there. I know I was there one time, 31 days, and I'm running around all over the back of the VA down there, trying to find a place to climb across the fence, and all I had to do was walk out the door. Walk out the gate. It wasn't locked up. I wasn't even on lockup. All I had to do was just walk out the front of the VA and walk right on out to old Highway 11 and go home. And I'm way back on the backside of the golf course over there and where the shrubbery is, trying to find a place to get over that big high fence. And all this kind of stuff. But I do know in 1975 they kept me 5 days and shipped me right out of there. They throwed me right out of there. Said, we don't need you. And all of these old things, you know. Man, this is just wonderful. And my son is so close to me today. And, you know, I was talking about humility while ago on the seventh step. And there's a lot about humility in the 12 by 12 and the 12th tradition, too. God, I don't want to get on them. I can stay on the traditions and concepts and all that stuff for 2 hours up here. But the 12th tradition, you know, we cannot put principles, personalities before principles. We can't do it. We just cannot put personalities before principles. I can break my own anonymity, but I should never break my anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. I should have enough of sacrifice and humility to never break my anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. Or your anonymity. But I can break my anonymity, and I like to talk to people that need help. And the church all the time. You know, in 1975, that's what I was getting back on. I got started in church, and I went to church regularly for 3.5 years. And I got mad at some of the elders in church and some of the deacons in church, and I was drunk for the next 4 solid years. I was drunk. From part of 79 to 83. And talking about humility, I want to tell this, and then I'm going to get on off and shut up and sit down and maybe go to a meeting here at the choir. But anyway, I was selling snuff, and I was over in Clay County. That's pretty close to the Georgia line, close to Roanoke, Alabama. And I hooked up to this old house, and there was about 8 people on the front porch, and they're all dipping snuff. And this old boy over here, he had some dental, and he had about 5 empty jars, and the guy next to him is his brother, and he had some, and he had some, and he had some. That lady over here, the old granny, and she had 4 or 5 jars, and she, her sons had some. I gave them all some samples. And man, that liquor was coming out of me because I'd been to Phoenix City that night, and that was before they cleaned Phoenix City up. Slot machines and everything else down there, and women, and that's where all my money went. But I was sweating. And I give them all some snuff, and I said, "Lady, I said, y'all got a well around here?" She said, "Yeah, snuff man." Said, "Clem?" Now listen, Clem was the old boy sitting over there that had the 5 empty jars of dental. And that dental, sweet snuff, was flowing all down through him. Listen, he was what we called a heavy user. He was a heavy user. So I says, "Yeah, what about your well? Do you have a well back in the back somewhere?" "Yeah, snuff man." Says Clem, pointed at Clem now. Said, "Take the old snuff man back there in the back," said. "We'll all go back there," and said, "You join the bucket of water." My God, we went back there. Old Clem dropped that big bucket. Is anybody old enough to know what them big long buckets look like? They wasn't them big buckets big around. They was them long buckets about this big around. That was a drill well. You know, just went right down in the cement. Old Clem wound up that thing, and I said, "Hey, lady, what the hell do you want me to drink out of?" She said, "Snuff man, can't you see that gourd dipper hanging up over there?" Well, I knew what a gourd dipper was. We were very poor, but we had aluminum dipper at home anyway. But anyway, she said, "We all drank out of that gourd dipper." What do you think I thought about first of all? Is Clem been drinking out of that dipper? So, anyway, old Clem drew up that thing, and he filled that dipper up, and he handed it to me. Pretty gourd dipper. I looked at that thing, and right on the end of that gourd dipper, the handle was clipped off just like you took a pocket knife and clipped it off just so smooth that it just clipped right off. I saw that, and I said, "By God, I got this damn bunch of turkey now." So I grabbed that dipper and turned that thing up, drank every bit of that water right out the end of that handle. And that old lady came over to me, and she put her arm around my neck and hugged me and said, "Son, you the first man I ever saw drink out of the dipper just like Clem does." So, I'm going to tell you, folks, you know, you talk about humility. Well, you know, huh? Talk about humility. We alcoholics humiliated ourselves. All our lives we humiliated ourselves to the point where we wanted to do something about it, and we got sober. But that was the very first lesson in humility that I ever got. And I thought about that when I read and studied the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on the 7th step, when it talks about humility. And you know, going back about the steps, that's something that I'll always have, is character defects. Never will I get rid of character defects. Can you just imagine us alcoholics walking around with a white robe on, with a halo on, just walking around? Hell, we wouldn't even have nothing to say to each other. How would I take somebody's inventory? I'd be perfect. You know, I couldn't go up to old Joe over there and say, "Hey, Joe, do you know so-and-so was drunk the other night?" We'd all be perfect. We'd just be walking around with a white robe on the halo. God does not render us white as snow. That's in the 12 of 12. In the 4th step. On Captain Defense. I'm going to always have Captain Defense. I might want to hold on to some of them. I don't know. And shortcomings, I'm going to always have some shortcomings. But Bill Wilson knew that we had 5 character defects that he wanted an alcoholic to get rid of. That was resentment, self-pity, fear, problem with sex, and false pride. God almighty, damn, we used to go down to Wilson's, and I loved to dance. Me and my wife did. And I didn't want them people down there to know how much booze I was drinking. You know what I'd do? I'd take a little half a pint. A half a pint of booze and 16 miniatures. I'd take them miniatures and wrap them in 8 different little packages. I'd put 2 in this toilet tissue, wrap it up real tight with double toilet paper. and where it wouldn't rattle. I'd put four in this pocket, two doubles, four in this pocket, two doubles, four fold 16. I got me 16.5 ounces in there, plus that 0.5 pound. And when I would take a little drink of mine, I'd sip in this stuff. And putting up with letting somebody put a little cherry on the side of one of them drinks. And looking around to see if anybody could see me and spitting that damn cherry out and swallowing that thing real quick and filling it up where they'd think I'm still just tasting it. And run back to the toilet, knock the top out a couple of these miniatures and down them right quick, and walk right back in and somebody says, "Hey, Robert, would you have a little drink with us?" "No, I done had all I want for tonight." My God almighty. That is false pride. And but when I was going to the bars, this was before I got all my clothes got to being torn off. I'm in Birmingham. I wondered why my clothes was being torn off. I mean, you know, breeches would have holes in the knees and seats would be ripped and all that damn stuff. I was going into nightclubs and being thrown out the back door. So that's why I started having to go to the bootleggers and drink with them. But all of that stuff. And, you know, I was, you know, I didn't want nobody to know what I was drinking. I would drink three drinks at your nightclub and I'm in the rubber business. They asked me what kind of business I'm in. I'm in the rubber business, man. I worked at Goodyear. Wasn't nothing but just in, I was a checker, that's all. But, hell, by the third drink, I done, you know, I'm superintendent of the ship. And by the time I pass out in Birmingham, I am plant director. I done made several bars. And that's that false pride, see? I had all that false pride. Today, I ask God to give me more love, tolerance, patience, courage, wisdom, and humility. Love, tolerance, and patience will take care of resentments. You won't have any. Courage will take care of fear. I ask God to give me wisdom to do thy will, and wisdom will take care of any sex problem that may come up. And I don't really have any problem with that today. I don't need no sex seminar. What I need is a damn memory course. So, and then humility takes care of that false pride, see? Humility takes care of that false pride. And something was bothering me two years ago, and I got to tell you this, then I'm going to shut up. I was worried about my wife and her mother and her sisters because her mother, her dad had died, and he was 91 years old last year, and he died. And then her mother's 91 now, and we're having to have three people set up with her and do the housework and take care of her. And it got where one of them had quit and couldn't get nobody, and things was bothering me. And I called my best friend up here, and he said, "You better start reading the book." He said, "Get your 12 of 12 down." His answer's in there. And I started reading, and I got to the 11th step, and I read the St. Francis Prayer again. And at the very end of it, I found what he wanted me to find. And I started praying to let me comfort rather than be comforted, to let me love rather than be loved, and let me understand rather than to be understood. And things got pretty good. Not a solution that the alcoholic hadn't got. I don't care what he's got, the solution, the answer to is in here. There ain't never been a problem that ain't a solution to. We got enough of literature and Alcoholics Anonymous to solve all our problems if we're willing, open-minded, or willing, honest, and open-minded. We can get sober and stay sober. There's one principle above all other principles that might keep the alcoholic from ever getting sober, and that's the principle of contempt prior to investigation. And if you don't want to investigate the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's your business. I make a lot of 12-step calls, and I'm one of them that call a wet drunk. You know what that is. You don't have many people calling a wet drunk today, but I do because I love it. It keeps me sober. And I'm continuously doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the great thing is that I can go back to people in church today, and they look at me with respect in their eyes, and I can smile and talk with them. And I'm happy today. And me and my wife have more fun today together than we've ever had before. And we go to roundups together. And if we don't, well, I go and she goes. It's a wonderful life. And it's all through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if anybody's ever heard me speak or talk before. But I usually talk about 55 minutes. And I may look at my watch a lot of times. It's a damn habit. It's just a habit. I've never been able to make it through before 55 minutes. And I've enjoyed this tonight, being up here with especially all you young people. And this was fabulous, seeing these people come up here. And I sat back there and cried tonight when the man come up here that had 28 years. And his son got his dad. I heard about John. Talked with John about someone close to him. My son had a real bad problem. And I had to let him go. He was 26 years old. He's 40 now. He was 40 years old, February 23rd. He got married when he was 34, and he just stopped. He just stopped drinking. He'd gotten DUIs and things like that. I got him out of jail a time or two. And then I just quit. I was still drinking. I couldn't say anything. But he don't drink today. He just quit. And that's good. My daddy had 23 brothers and sisters. I had a lot of first cousins. I had a lot of uncles that drank. My dad, like I said, he drank, and I didn't see him sober. But Robert Horton's the one that got the wagon in the ditch. And Robert Horton got the wagon out of the ditch. And it was by the grace of God. And you people that I love so dearly in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you again for asking me up here.